returned Jenny. I stopped to listen. But other than the distant sound of clucking hens, I could hear nothing but my own breathing. I tiptoed softly along between the tumbled-down sheds, paying close attention to my peripheral vision, aware that at any moment something could pounce upon me from a darkened doorway. It wasn't until then that I noticed the tracks on the ground, tiny footprints that could only have been made by the waffle-patterned soles of a child's Dunlop rubber boot. With all of my senses on high alert, I followed their trail. On past the machine shed they led me, past the rusting hulk of an ancient tractor that leaned crazily to one side, missing a back wheel, looking for all the world like something half sunk in the sands, some ancient engine cast up by the sea. Another jog to the left, and I found myself at the foot of the Dovecote, which towered above me like a fairy tale castle, its piebald bricks stained almost golden by the late light of day. Although I had been here before, it had been by a different route, and I slowly crept round it to the decrepit wooden door, the sharp pong of pigeon droppings already beginning to fill my nostrils. Perhaps I had been wrong, I thought for a moment. Perhaps the boy in the sailor suit had run straight down past the tower and was, by now, well away across the fields. But the footprints in the soil proved otherwise. They led straight to the Dovecote door. Something brushed against my leg and my heart nearly stopped. "Yow!" said a voice. It was Tok, the more vocal of the Ingleby's cats. I put a finger to my lips to shush her before I remembered that cats don't read sign language. But perhaps they do, for without another sound, she crouched low to the ground and slunk off into the shadows of the Dovecote's interior. Hesitantly, I followed her. Inside, the place was as I remembered it, the myriad lights beaming in through chinks in the ancient brickwork, the claustrophobic dust-choked air. This time, though, there was no banshee keening spilling out from the room above. The place was as silent as the crypt that lies beneath Death's own castle. I put one foot onto the scaffolding and peered up to where it disappeared into the gloom above my head. The old wood let out a baleful croak and I paused. Whoever, or whatever, was above me in the near darkness, knew now that I had them cornered. "Hello," I called out, as much to cheer myself as anything. "Hello, it's me, Flavia. Anyone up there?" The only sound from above was the buzzing of bees round the upper windows of the Dovecote, grotesquely amplified by the tower's hollow structure. "Don't be frightened," I called. "I'm coming up." Little by little, one small step at a time, I began my precarious ascent. Again, I felt like Jack, this time climbing the beanstalk, dragging myself up, inch by inch, to face some unknown horror. The old wood creaked horribly, and I knew that it could crumble at any moment, dashing me down to certain death on the flagstones below, in much the same way that the giant, and Rupert, had come crashing down upon the puppet stage. The climb seemed to go on forever. I stopped to listen. There was still no sound but that of the bees. Up and up I went again, shifting my feet carefully from one wooden rung to the next, clutching at the cross pieces with fingers that were already beginning to grow numb. As my eyes at last came level with the arched opening, the interior of the upper chamber came into view. A figure was hunched over the shrine to Robin Ingleby, the same figure that had fled the farmhouse. On its knees, its back turned to me, the small apparition was dressed in a white and navy sailor suit with a midi collar and short trousers. The waffle soles of its Dunlop rubber boots were almost in my face. I could have reached out and touched them. My knees began to tremble violently, threatening to buckle and send me plummeting down into the stony abyss. "Help me," I said, the words brought up suddenly, inexplicably and surprisingly, from some ancient and reptilian part of my brain. A hand reached out, white fingers seized mine, and with surprising strength hauled me up to safety. A moment later, I found myself crouched, safe but trembling, face to face with the spectre. While the white sailor suit, with its crown and anchored jacket, and the Dunlop boots undoubtedly belonged to the dead Robin Ingleby, the strained and haggard face that stared back at me from beneath the beribboned HMS Hood hat was that of his tiny mother, Grace. "You!" I said, unable to restrain myself. "It was you!" Her face was sad and suddenly very, very old. It was hard to believe that there remained in this woman a single atom of Grace Tennyson, that happy, outgoing girl who had once so cheerfully conquered the wired innards of Peter the Great, the silver samovar at the St. Nicholas Tea Room. "Robin's gone," she said with a cough. "The devil took him." "The devil took him!" Almost the same words Mad Meg had used in Gibbet Wood. "And who was the devil, Mrs. Ingleby?" I thought for a while it was Rupert, but it wasn't. "It was you, wasn't it?" "Rupert's dead now," she said, touching her fingers to her temples as if she were dazed. "Yes," I said, "Rupert's dead. He was the Punch and Judy man at the seaside, wasn't he? You had arranged to meet him there, and Robin saw you together. You were afraid he would tell Gordon." She gave me a half canny smile. "At the seaside?" she said with a chuckling cough. No, not at the seaside. Here, in the dovecote." I had suspected for some time that the single set of footprints, the ones that had been found 5 years ago leading up Jubilee Field to Gibbet Wood, had been those of Grace Ingleby, carrying the dead Robin in her arms. In order to leave only his footprints, she had put on her child's rubber boots. They were, after all, the same size as her own. As if to prove it, she was wearing them now. 5 years after his death, she was still dressing up in Robin's clothing, trying desperately to conjure her son back from the dead. Or to atone for what she had done. "You carried him to the wood and hung him from a tree. But Robin died here, didn't he? That's why you've made this his shrine and not his bedroom." How matter-of-fact it sounded, this nightmare conversation with a madwoman. I knew that if ever I made it safely home to Buckshaw, I was going to be in need of a long, hot, steaming bath. "I told him to stay down," she said rather petulantly. "Go back to the house, Robin," I called out. "You mustn't come up here." But he wouldn't listen. Little boys are like that sometimes, disobedient. She coughed again and shook her head ruefully. "I can do a trick with the rope," he shouted back. He'd been playing cowboy all day with a rope he'd found in a shed. Just as Sally had said, Grace must be telling me the truth. "He climbed up here before we could stop him. Rupert was furious. He grabbed at Robin to give him a shake, but his iron brace slipped on the bricks. Robin." Now, silent tears were coursing down her face. "Fell?" I said. There was no need to elaborate. "Fell," she repeated, and the way she dragged out the word made it echo from the bricks, hovering grotesquely in the round chamber, a sound I would never forget. With it came an idea. Was it Rupert who thought of the Punch and Judy story? That Robin had been playing out the scene with Punch and the hangman?
"Where
did you hear that?" she demanded, suddenly lucid, canny. I thought of Mad Meg's smile in Gibbet Wood. These two women had so much in common. "Your evidence to the jury at the inquest," I answered. "It's public knowledge." I did not think it necessary to add that I had heard it from Sally.
"He made me do it," she said, wiping her eyes on the sleeve of the sailor suit, and I realized for the first time how much she looked like Robin. Once noticed, the resemblance was eerie.
"Rupert told me no one would ever know. Robin's neck was broken in the fall, and if I...
A shudder ran through her entire body.
"If I wouldn't do as he ordered, he'd tell Gordon what had been going on between us. I'd be the one to be punished. Gordon's quick with his fists, you know."
As was Rupert. I'd seen the bruises he left on Nia's arm. Two quick-tempered men, and rather than fighting it out between them, they both had made punching bags of their women.
"Was there no one you could talk to? The vicar, for instance?"
This seemed to set her off, and she was racked by a siege of coughing. I waited until she had finished.
"The vicar," she said, gasping for breath, "is the only one who has made these past 5 years bearable."
"He knew about Robin?"
I could hardly believe it.
"A clergyman's lips are sealed," she said. "He's never breathed a word. He tried to come to Culverhouse Farm once a week, just to let me talk. The man's a saint."
"His wife thought he was."
"In love with you?"
She nodded, squeezing her eyes tight shut as if she were in excruciating pain.
"Are you all right?"
I asked. "Wait a few minutes," she said, "and I shall be fine." Her body was crumbling before my eyes, tipping towards the opening into the shaft. I grabbed at her arm, and as I did so, a glass bottle that she had been clutching in her fist fell to the brick floor and bounced away, clinking into the corner, sending a pigeon clattering up towards the opening. I dragged Grace into the centre of the chamber and sprang after the bottle, which had come to rest in a mound of ancient guano. The label told me all I needed to know. Calcium cyanide, it said. Poison. Rat poison. The stuff was in common farm use, particularly on those farms whose hen houses attract vermin. There was still one of the white tablets in the bottom. I removed the stopper and smelled it. Nothing. Grace was now flat on the floor, twitching, her limbs flailing. I dropped to my knees and sniffed her lips. The scent of bitter almonds. The tablets of calcium cyanide, I knew, as soon as they met the moisture of her mouth, throat, and stomach, would produce hydrogen cyanide, a toxic gas that could kill in 5 minutes. There was no time to waste. Her life was in my hands. I almost panicked at the thought, but I didn't. I took a careful look round, registering every detail. Aside from the candle, the shrine, the photograph of Robin, and his toy sailboat, there was nothing in the chamber but rubble. Well, not quite nothing. On one wall was an ancient watering device for the birds, an inverted glass bulb and tube whose gravity feed kept a dish full for the pigeons to dip their beaks into. From the clarity of the water, it seemed as if Grace had recently filled it. A glass cock allowed the gravity feed to be turned off. I gave it a twist and pulled the full dish carefully out of its spring clips. Grace moaned horribly on the floor, apparently no longer aware of my presence. Treading carefully, I moved to the spot from which the pigeon had flown. Feeling gingerly in the straw with my fingertips, I was quickly rewarded. An egg. No, two little eggs. Putting them down gently beside the dish, I picked up the sailboat. At the bottom of its tin keel was a lead weight. Damn! I wedged the thing into the crack between two bricks in the windowsill and pulled for all I was worth, then pulled again. The third time, the weight snapped off. Using the sharp bottom edge of the keel as a makeshift putty knife, I leaned out the opening to the wide shelf that had served for centuries as a perch. Below me, the farmyard was empty. No sense wasting time by yelling for help. I ground the thin keel along the ledge until I had gathered what I needed, then scraped it off with a reluctant finger into the water dish. One step left. Although their small size made it a tricky bit of work, I cracked the eggs, one at a time, the way Mrs. Mullet had taught me. A sharp rap in the middle, then using the two halves of the shell like twin egg cups, tipping the yolk back and forth from one to the other until the last of the whites had oozed away into the waiting water dish. Taking up the glass pill bottle, I used it as a pestle, twisting, grinding, and stirring until I had perhaps half a teacup of greyish curded mud with the slightest tinge of yellow. So that neither of us would knock it over, Grace was now kicking feebly and pink in the face from lack of oxygen. I sat down beside her, cross-legged on the floor, and pulled her head into my lap, face upwards. She was too weak to resist. Then, seizing her nose between my thumb and forefinger, I pulled open her mouth, hoping that, in her spasms, she wouldn't bite me. She snapped it shut at once. This was not going to be as easy as I had thought. I pinched her nose a little tighter. Now, if she wanted to breathe at all, it was going to have to be through her mouth. I hated myself for what I was doing to her. She struggled, her eyes bulging, and then her mouth flew open and she sucked in a breath of air, then snapped it shut again. As slowly and as gently as I could, I leaned over and picked up the brimming dish, awaiting the proper moment. It came sooner than I expected. With a gasp, Grace's mouth flew open, and as she sucked in air again, I dumped the contents of the dish into her mouth and slammed it shut with the heel of my hand under her chin. The empty dish fell to the floor with a crash. But Grace was fighting me. I could see that. Some part of her was so dead set on dying that she was keeping the stuff in her mouth, refusing to swallow. With the little finger of my right hand, I began prodding at her gullet like a seabird digging in the sand. We must have looked like Greek wrestlers, she with her head locked tightly in the crook of my arm, me bending over her, trembling with the sheer physical effort of trying to keep her from spitting out the nauseating mixture. And then, just before she went limp, I heard her swallow. She was no longer resisting. I carefully pried open her mouth. Aside from a faint and distasteful glistening of foreign matter, it was empty. I raced to the window, leaning out as far as I could into the sunshine. My heart sank. The farmyard was still empty. Then suddenly there was a noise of machinery in the lane, and a moment later the grey Fergie came clattering into view, Sally bouncing at the wheel and Dieter dangling his long legs over the gate of the trailer. "Sally! Dieter!" I shouted. At first they didn't know where my voice was coming from. They were looking everywhere round the yard, perplexed. "Up here, in the dovecote!" I dug in my pocket, fished out Alf's willow whistle, and blew into it like a demented bobby. At last they spotted me. Sally gave a wave. "It's Grace," I hollered. "She's taken poison. Telephone Dr. Darby and tell him to come at once." Dieter was already dashing for the farmhouse, running full tilt, the way he must once have done when scrambling for his Messerschmitt. "And tell him to make sure he's got amyl nitrate and sodium thiosulfate in his bag," I shouted, in spite of a couple of wayward tears. "He's going to need them."
Chapter 28
"Pigeon droppings," Inspector Hewitt said, for perhaps the third time. "You're telling me that you concocted an antidote from pigeon droppings?" We were sitting in the vicar's study, sizing one another up. "Yes," I said. "I had no other choice. Pigeon guano, when it's left outdoors in the sunlight, is remarkably high in NaNO3, sodium nitrate, which is why I had to scrape it from the outside perch, rather than using the older stuff that was in the chamber. Sodium nitrate is an antidote to cyanide poisoning. I used the whites of pigeon's eggs to produce the suspension. I hope she's all right."
"She's fine," the inspector said. although we're seeking an opinion about whether to charge you with practicing medicine without a license."
I studied his face to see if he was teasing, but he didn't seem to be.
"But," I protested, "Dr. Darby said he couldn't have done better himself."
"Which isn't saying much," the inspector said, looking away from me and out the window. I saw that I had him beaten.
Inspector Hewitt had flagged me down on my way back to Buckshaw and asked me to account for my presence at Culverhouse Farm. A hastily fabricated story about fetching eggs for Mrs. Mullet, who wanted to make an angel food cake, seemed to have got me off the hook, at least for now. The inspector had assured me that Grace Ingleby was still alive, that she had been taken to the hospital at Henley. He did not say that my antidote had saved her life. I supposed only time would tell. The vicar, having given up his desk and chair to Inspector Hewitt, stood like a black stork in the corner, rubbing at his eyeglasses with a linen handkerchief. As Detective Sergeant Woolmer stood at one of the windows, pretending to polish an anastigmat lens from his precious camera, Detective Sergeant Graves glanced up from his notes just long enough to give me a beaming smile. I'd like to think that the almost imperceptible shake of his head that came with it was a sign of admiration. And even though they're not yet aware of one another, I also like to think that Sergeant Graves will one day marry my rotten sister Ophelia and carry her off to a vine-covered cottage just far enough from Buckshaw that I can drop in whenever I feel like it for a good old gab about murder. But now there was Dieter to take into account. Life was becoming so complicated.
"Just begin at the beginning," Inspector Hewitt said, suddenly back from his reverie. "I want to make sure we haven't missed anything."
Was I detecting a note of sarcasm? I hoped not, since I really liked the man, although he could be somewhat slow. Mrs. Ingleby, Grace, was having an affair with Rupert Pawson. Rupert had been coming to Culverhouse Farm for years because Gordon supplied him with marijuana. It eased the pain of his polio, you see. He must have sensed my hesitation.
"No need to worry about betraying him," he said. "Mr. Ingleby has been most frank with us. It's your version I want to hear."
"Rupert and Grace arranged to meet at the seaside years ago," I said. "Robin saw them there together. He stumbled upon them again, later, in the Dovecote. Rupert made a grab for him, or something like that, and Robin tumbled down the central shaft and broke his neck. It was an accident, but still, Robin was dead. Rupert cooked up the idea of having Grace take his body, after dark, to Gibbet Wood and hang it from a tree. Robin had been seen by several people playing with a rope. It was Rupert, too, who invented the story that Robin had been playing out the scene between Punch and Jack Ketch, that he had seen at the seaside puppet show. Punch and the Hangman's Tale is one that's known to every child in England. No one would question the story that Robin had accidentally hanged himself. It was just bizarre enough to be true. As a well-known puppeteer, Rupert couldn't afford to have his name linked in any way with the death of a child. He needed to erase himself from the scene of Robin's death. No one but Grace knew he had been at the farm that day. That's why he threatened her. He told her that if she didn't do as he wanted, he would spill the beans to Gordon. Sorry, I mean that he would inform Gordon that he'd been carrying on an affair with his wife. Grace would lose both her son and her husband. She was already half mad with grief and fear, so it was probably quite easy to manipulate her. Because she's so small, she was able to put on Robin's rubber boots to carry his body up to Gibbet Wood. She's remarkably strong for her size. I found that out when she hauled me up into the Dovecote chamber. After she'd hung Robin's body from the tree, she put the boots on his feet and went home the long way round, barefoot. Inspector Hewitt nodded and scribbled a note in his microscopic handwriting. Mad Meg came upon the body hanging there and thought it was the devil's work. I've already given you the page from my notebook, so you've seen the drawing she made. She's quite good, actually, don't you think?
The inspector said.
It was a bad habit he was picking up by associating too much with Dr. Darby. That's why she was afraid to touch him, or even tell anyone. Robin's body hung there in Chibbit Wood until Dieter found it. Last Saturday at the church hall, when Meg saw Robin's face on Jack, the puppet, she thought the devil had brought the dead boy back to life, shrunk him, and put him to work on the stage. Meg has her times very badly mixed up. You can tell that from the drawing. The robin hanging from the tree is a sight she saw 5 years ago. The vicar taking his clothes off in the wood is something she saw last Thursday. The vicar went beet red and ran a finger round the inside of his clerical collar.
Yes, well, you see...
Oh, I knew you had come a cropper, vicar, I said. I knew it the instant I saw you in the graveyard, the day you met Rupert and Nia, remember? Your trouser leg was ripped, you were covered with chalky smudges from the road at Culverhouse Farm, and you'd lost your bicycle clip.
So I had, the vicar said. My trousers got caught up in the ruddy chain, and I was catapulted into the ditch.
Which explains why you went in among the trees of Chibbit Wood, to take off your clothes, to try to clean them up. You were afraid of what Cynthia would say. Sorry, Mrs. Richardson, I mean. You said as much in the churchyard. Something about Cynthia having you on the carpet. The vicar remained silent, and I don't think I ever admired him more than I did in that moment. Because you've been going to Culverhouse Farm at least once a week since Robin died 5 years ago, Cynthia, Mrs. Richardson, I mean, had somehow got the idea that there was more in your meetings with Grace Ingleby than met the eye. That's why you've recently been keeping your visit secret.
I'm not really at liberty to discuss that, the vicar said. The wearing of the dog collar puts paid to any tendency one has to be a chatterbox, but I must put in her defence, that Cynthia is very loyal. Her life is not always an easy one.
Nor is Grace Ingleby's, I pointed out.
No, nor is Grace's.
At any rate, I went on, Meg lives in an old shack somewhere in the depths of Chibbit Wood. She doesn't miss much that goes on there.
Or anywhere else, I wanted to add.
It had only just occurred to me that it was almost certainly Meg that Rupert and Nia had heard prowling round near their tent in the churchyard. She saw you taking your trousers off beside the old gallows at the very spot where she had seen Robin hanging. That's why she drew you into her picture.
I see, said the vicar. At least, I think I see.
Meg picked up your trouser clip in the road, meaning to use it for one of those dangling sculpture things of hers, but she recognised it as yours and...
It has my initials on it, the vicar said. Cynthia scratched them on.
Meg can't read, I said, but she's very observant. Look at the detail in her drawing. She even remembered the little Church of England pin in your lapel.
Good heavens, the vicar said, coming round to peer over Inspector Hewitt's shoulder. So she did.
She came here on Saturday afternoon to return the trouser clip, and while she was looking for you, she happened to wander into the parish hall during Rupert's performance. When she saw the shrunken Robin on the stage, she went into a right old squiff. You and Nia carried her off to the vicarage and tucked her in on your couch in the study. That's when the clip, and Nia's compact, fell out of her pocket. I found the compact on the floor behind the couch the next day. I didn't find the bicycle clip because Grace Ingleby had already picked it up the day before.
Hold on, the inspector said. No one's claiming to have seen Mrs. Ingleby anywhere near the vicarage or the parish hall on Saturday afternoon.
Nor did they, I said. What they did say was that the egg lady had been there. Had Inspector Hewitt been the sort of man whose mouth was prone to falling open when astonished, he'd have been gaping like a gargoyle.
Good Lord, he said flatly. Who told you that?
Mrs. Roberts and Miss Roper, I said. They were in the vicarage kitchen after church yesterday. I assumed you had questioned them.
I believe we did, Inspector Hewitt said, cocking an eyebrow at Sergeant Graves, who flipped back through the pages of his notebook. Yes, sir, said Sergeant Grace. They both gave in statements, but there was nothing said about egg ladies.
The egg lady was Grace Ingleby, of course, I said helpfully. She came down from Culverhouse Farm late on Saturday afternoon with eggs for the vicarage. There was no one else around. Something made her go into the vicar's study. Perhaps she heard Meg snoring, I don't know. But she found the bicycle clip on the floor, picked it up and pocketed it.
How can you be so sure? Asked Inspector Hewitt.
I can't be sure, I said. What I can be sure of, because he told me so, is that the vicar lost his bicycle clip last Thursday. The vicar nodded in agreement. On the road at Gibbet Hill, and that you and I, Inspector, found it on Sunday morning clamped to the rail of the puppet theatre. The rest is mere guesswork. The inspector scratched at his nose, made another note, and looked up at me as if he had been short-changed.
Which brings us neatly back to Rupert Pawson, he said.
Yes, I replied, which brings us neatly back to Rupert Pawson.
About whom you are about to enlighten us.
I ignored his twitting and went on. Grace had known Rupert for years, perhaps since even before she met Gordon. For all I know, she might even have travelled with him at one time as his assistant. I knew by the sudden closed look on Inspector Hewitt's face that I had hit the nail on the head. Bravo, Flavia, I thought. Go to the head of the class. There were times when I surprised even myself. And even if she hadn't, I added, she'd certainly attended some of the shows he put on round the countryside. She'd have paid particular attention to the electrical rigging. Since Rupert manufactured all of his own lighting equipment, I can hardly believe that he wouldn't have taken the opportunity to show off the details to a fellow electrician. He was rather vain about his skills, you know. I expect Grace took the keys from the vicarage and walked straight away through the churchyard to the parish hall. The afternoon performance was over by that time. The audience had gone, and so had Rupert. There was little chance of her being seen. Even if she had been spotted, no one would have paid her the slightest attention, would they? After all, she was just the egg lady. Besides, she and her husband are parishioners of St. Tancred's, so no one would have given her a second look. She went into the hall and, using the corridor to the left and locking the door behind her, went up the two short flights of steps to the stage. She climbed up onto the bridge of the puppet stage and scraped away the insulation from the wiring, using the bicycle clip as a kind of spokeshave. Then she slipped the clip over the wooden framework of the stage, touching the bared electrical wire on one side and the metal rod that released Galligantus on the other. Bob's your uncle. That's all there was to it. If you've had a close look at the clip, you've likely already found a small abrasion mark on the inside centre, and perhaps slight traces of copper. "'Struth!" Sergeant Woolman let slip, and Inspector Hewitt shot him a look.
Unlike most of the other suspects, except Dieter, of course, who built wireless sets as a boy in Germany, Grace Ingleby had the necessary electrical training. Before the war, before marrying Gordon, she worked in a factory installing radio sets in Spitfires. I've been told that her IQ is nearly equal in number to the Psalms.
Damn it!
Inspector Hewitt shouted, leaping to his feet.
Sorry, Vicar. But why haven't we found these things out, Sergeant?
He glared from one of his men to the other, including both in his exasperation.
With respect, sir, Sergeant Woolmer ventured, it could be because we're not Miss Deluce.
It was a bold thing to say, and a rash one. If what I'd seen in the pictures at the cinema were true, it was the sort of remark that could result in the sergeant becoming a road mender before sunset. After a nerve-wracking silence, the inspector said,
"You're right, of course, Sergeant. We don't have the same entree to the homes and hearths of Bishop's Lacey, do we? It's an area in which we could do better. Make a note of it."
No wonder his subordinates adored him.
"Yes, sir," said Sergeant Graves, scribbling something in his notebook.
"Then," I went on, "having set the trap,
Grace went out by the hallway door at the right of the stage, and she locked that one too, probably to keep anyone from going backstage and discovering what she had done. Not that anyone would, of course, but I expect she was under a great deal of stress. She's been planning to take her revenge on Rupert for a long time. It wasn't until she spotted the vicar's trouser clip on the floor that she saw exactly how it could be done. As I've said, she's a very intelligent woman.
But, Inspector Hewitt said, if both doors were locked, how did Pawson get up onto the stage for the performance? He couldn't have locked himself in because he didn't have the key.
He used that little staircase in front of the stage, I said. It's not as steep as the two in the side halls, and it's only a single flight. Narrow stairs were difficult for Rupert because of his leg brace, and he took the shortest route. I noticed that about him last Thursday when he was checking the hall's acoustics.
Quite an ingenious theory, Inspector Hewitt remarked. But it doesn't explain everything. How, for instance, would the alleged murderer know that such a gimcrack bit of tin would result in Pawson's death?
Because Rupert always leaned on a rail of iron piping as he operated the puppets. With all the lighting equipment that was hung backstage, the railing had to be grounded through the mains. The instant Rupert touched the live Galligantus lever, his lower body pressed tight against the rail as it was, with his right leg clamped in an iron brace, the current would have shot straight up his arm and through...
His heart, said the inspector. Yes, I see.
Rather like St. Lawrence, I said, who, as you know, was done to death on a grill.
Thank you, Flavia, Inspector Hewitt said. I think you've made your point.
Yes, I said, rather smugly. So do I. Will that be all, then?
Sergeant Graves was grinning away over his notebook like Scrooge over his ledgers.
Inspector Hewitt wrinkled his brow in a look that I had seen before, a look of exasperated curiosity held in firm check by years of training and a strong sense of duty.
I think so, yes. Except for one or two small points, perhaps.
I gave him that beaming, superior smile, all teeth and thin lips. I almost hated myself for doing it.
Yes, Inspector?
He walked to the window, his hands clasped behind his back, as I had seen him do before on several occasions. At last he turned.
Perhaps I'm a bit of a dim bulb, he said.
If he was waiting for me to contradict him, he'd be waiting until the cows came home in purple pyjamas.
Your observations on the death of Rupert Pawson have been most illuminating, but try as I may, I have failed utterly to follow your reasoning in the death of Robin Ingleby.
The boots? Yes, perhaps.
It's a possibility, I admit, but far from a certainty. Slender evidence when it comes to court, if the case is reopened, that is. But we shall require far more than a pair of child's boots if we are to prevail again upon their lordships.
His tone was almost pleading. I had already decided that there were certain observations that would remain forever locked away in my brain, choice nuggets of deduction that I would keep for my own private delectation. After all, the inspector had far more resources at his disposal than I did. But then I thought of his beautiful wife, Antigone. Whatever would she think of me if she found that I had thwarted him?
One thing was certain. It would scotch any idea I might have had of sipping tea in the garden of their tastefully decorated maisonette.
Very well, I said reluctantly. There are a few more points. The first is this. When Dieter went running back to the farmyard, having just discovered Robin's dead body hanging in Gibbet Wood, the windows of the house were empty. No one was awaiting his arrival, as might have been expected. Surely the mother of a missing child would be frantic, waiting for the slightest scrap of news. But Grace Ingleby wasn't keeping watch at the windows. And why not? The reason is a simple one. She already knew that Robin was dead. Somewhere behind me, the vicar gasped.
I see, Inspector Hewitt nodded.
An ingenious theory.
Most ingenious. but still hardly enough to build a case upon.
Granted, I agreed, but there's more. I looked from one of them to another, the vicar, Inspector Hewitt, and Sergeant Graves, their eager faces thrust forward, hanging upon my every word. Even the hulking Sergeant Woolmer slowed his polishing of the intricate lens.
Robin Ingleby's hair was always a haystack, I told them. Tousled is perhaps the proper word. You can see it in his photos. And yet when he was found hanging from the timbers of the old gallows, his hair was as neatly combed as if he'd just climbed down from the barber's chair. Meg captured it perfectly in her drawing. See? There was an intake of breath as everyone huddled over the page from my notebook. It was something that only a mother would do, I said. She couldn't resist. Grace Ingleby wanted her son to be presentable when he was found, hanging by the neck, dead, in Gibbet Wood.
Good Lord, Inspector Hewitt said.
Chapter 29.
Good Lord, Father exclaimed. There's Broadcasting House. They've set up cameras in Portland Place.
He got up from his chair for the umpteenth time and hurried across the drawing room to twiddle with the knobs on the television receiving set.
Please be quiet, Haviland, Aunt Felicity said. If they were interested in your commentary, the BBC would have sent for you.
Aunt Felicity, who had barely got home to Hampstead, had hurried back again to Buckshaw as soon as the idea came into her head. She had hired the television for the occasion.
At ruinous expense, she hastened to point out,
and because of it was now enjoying vastly increased dictatorial powers. Early in the morning of the previous day, the workmen had begun erecting a receiving aerial on the ramparts of Buckshaw.
It needs to be high enough to pick up the signal from the new transmitting tower at Sutton Coldfield, Aunt Felicity had said, in a voice that suggested television was her own invention. I had wanted all of us to go up to London to attend the Porson obsequies, she went on. But when Lady Burwash let slip that the Sitwells were having in the telly... No, no, don't protest, Haviland. It's educational. I'm only doing it for the good of the girls.
Several muscular workers, dressed in overalls, had lugged the set from the back of a pantechnicon and into the drawing room. There it now crouched, its single grey eye staring, like a flickering cyclops, at those of us gathered in its baleful glow. Daffy and Feely were huddled together on a Chesterfield, feigning boredom. Father had invited the vicar and told them to watch their language. Mrs. Mullet was enthroned in a comfortable wing-backed chair, and Dogger, who preferred not to sit in Father's presence, stood silently behind her.
I wonder if they have televisions in Portland Place, Feely said idly, or whether they might, rather, be looking out their windows.
I recognised this at once as an attempt to twit Father, whose contempt for television was legendary.
Television is a bauble, he would reply,
whenever we pleaded with him to have a receiver installed.
If God meant for pictures to be sent through the air, he'd have never given us the cinema. Or the National Gallery, he'd add sourly.
But in this case, he had been overruled.
But it's history, Haviland, Aunt Felicity had said in a loud voice. Would you have denied your daughters the opportunity to watch Henry V address his men on Crispin's Day?
She had taken up a stance in the middle of the drawing room.
This story shall the good man teach his son, and Crispin Crispian shall ne'er go by, from this day to the ending of the world, but we in it shall be remembered. We few, we happy few, we band of brothers. Nonsense, Father said, but Aunt Felicity, like Henry V, pushed on, undaunted. For he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother, be he ne'er so vile. This day shall gentle his condition, and gentlemen in England now abed shall think themselves accursed they were not here, and hold their manhoods cheap whiles any speaks that fought with us upon St. Crispin's Day.
That's all very well and good, but they didn't have television in 1415, Father had said rather sullenly, missing her point entirely. But then, yesterday, something remarkable had happened. One of the mechanics, who had been in the drawing room with his eye intently upon the receiver, had begun calling instructions out the window to a companion on the lawn who relayed them in a drill sergeant voice to the man on the roof.
"Hold it, Harry! Back, back, back! No, you've lost it! Back t'other way!"
At that very moment, Father had walked into the room, planning, I think, to heap scorn upon the entire operation, when his eye was taken by something on the snow-blown screen.
"Stop!" he shouted, and his word was passed along in ever-diminishing echoes by the mechanics, out the window and up onto the ramparts. "By George!" he said. "It's the 1856 British Guiana!" "Back a little!" he shouted, waving his hands to illustrate. Again his instructions were carried aloft in a verbal bucket brigade, and the picture cleared a little.
"Just as I thought," he said.
"I'd know it anywhere. It's coming to auction. Turn up the sound."
As fate would have it, the BBC was at that moment transmitting a programme on the topic of stamp collecting, and a moment later Father had pulled up a chair, fastened his wire-frame spectacles on the end of his nose, and refused to be budged.
"Quiet, Felicity," he barked when she tried to intervene. "This is of the utmost importance."
And so it was that Father had allowed the one-eyed beast to sit in his drawing room, at least for the time being. And now, as the hour drew near for Rupert's inhumation, a word I had heard Daffy trot out for Mrs. Mullet's benefit, Dog had drifted off to the foyer to admit the vicar who, even though he was not conducting the funeral, nevertheless felt the professional necessity of wringing the hands of each of us as he came into the room.
"Dear, dear," he said, "and to think that the poor chap expired right here in Bishop's Lacey."
No sooner had he taken a seat on the sofa than the doorbell sounded again, and a few moments later Dogger returned with an unexpected guest.
"Mr. Dieter Schrantz," he announced at the door, slipping effortlessly back into his role as butler.
Feely sprang to her feet and came floating across the drawing room to greet Dieter, hands outstretched, palms down, as if she were walking in her sleep. She was radiant. The vixen.
I was praying she'd trip on the rug. "Draw the drapes, please, Dogger," Father said,
and as Dogger complied, the light vanished from the room and left all of us sitting together in the gloom. Into view on the little tube, as I have said, floated the wet pavement of Portland Place in front of Broadcasting House, as the hushed and solemn voice of the BBC announcer took up the tale.
It may have been Richard Dimbleby, or perhaps it was just someone who sounded like him. "And now, from every corner of the realm, come the children. They are brought here today by their mothers and fathers, their nurses, their governesses, and some few, I dare say, by their grandparents. They have been standing here in Portland Place for hours in the rain, young and old, each patiently waiting his or her turn to bid a last, sad farewell to the man who captivated their hearts, to pay their respects to Rupert Porson, the genius who kidnapped them every afternoon at 4 from their everyday lives and, like the Pied Piper, led them away into his magic kingdom."
Genius? Well, that was stretching things a bit. Rupert was a brilliant showman, there was no doubt about it. But genius? The man was a scoundrel, a womanizer, a bully, a brute. But did that disqualify him from being a genius? I don't suppose it did. Brains and morals have nothing to do with one another. Take myself, for instance. I am often thought of as being remarkably bright, and yet my brains, more often than not,
are busily devising new and interesting ways of bringing my enemies to sudden, gagging, writhing, agonizing death. I am quite firm in my belief that poisons were put upon the earth in the first place, to be discovered, and put to good use, by those of us with the wits, but not necessarily the physical strength, to...
The poison!
I had completely forgotten about those doctored chocolates. Had Feely actually eaten them? It seemed unlikely. If she had, she wouldn't be sitting here with such maddening calm as Dieter, like a horse breeder admiring his filly over a paddock fence, gazed appreciatively upon her better points. The hydrogen sulfide I had injected into the sweets was not sufficient to kill, at any rate. Once inside the body, assuming that anyone was stupid enough to swallow it, it would oxidize to hydrogen sulfate, in which form it would be eliminated eventually in the urine. Was it such a crime, this thing that I had done? Dimethyl sulfide was dumped by the boatload into artificially flavored sweets, and no one, to the best of my knowledge, had yet been hanged for it. As my eyes became accustomed to the dimness of the drawing room, I was able to have a quick look round at the faces illuminated by the television's glow. Mrs. Mullet? No, Feely wouldn't have wasted her chocolates on Mrs. Mullet. Father and Dogger were out of the question too, as was the vicar. There was a remote possibility that Aunt Felicity had scarfed them, but if she had, her outraged trumpetings would have made even Sabu's elephant bolt for the hills. Therefore, the chocolates must still be in Feely's room. If only I could slip away, unnoticed in the semi-darkness.
Flavia, Father said, with a wave towards the little screen. I know how difficult this must be for you in particular. You may be excused if you wish.
Salvation! Off to the poison chocolates!
But wait. If I slunk away now, what would Dieter think of me? As for the others, I didn't give a rap. Well, perhaps a little for the vicar. But to be thought of as weak in the eyes of a man who had actually been shot down in flames.
Thank you, Father, I said. I think I shall manage to struggle through.
I knew it was the kind of stiff, upper-lippish response he wanted, and I was right. Having made the required parental noises, he sank back into his chair with something like a sigh. A froggish sound went up from the depths of the chair in the corner, and I knew instantly that it was Daffy. The television cameras were cutting away to the interior of Broadcasting House, to a large studio piled to the rafters with flowers, and there among them lay Rupert. Or at least his coffin, an ornate piece of furniture that mirrored the television lights and the nearby mourners in its highly polished surface, its silver-plated handles positively glistening in the gloom. Now another camera was showing a little girl as she approached the bier, hesitantly, tentatively, pushed forward in a series of thrusts by a self-conscious mother. The child wiped away a tear before placing a wreath of wildflowers at the rail in front of the coffin. The scene was cut to a close-up of a full-grown woman, weeping. Next, a man in funereal black stepped forward. He plucked three roses from the wall of floral tributes and presented each one delicately, one to the child, one to the mother, and the third to the weeping woman. Having done so, he pulled forth a large white handkerchief, turned away from the camera, and blew his nose with grief-stricken energy.
It was Mutt Wilmot. He was stage-managing the whole thing,
just as he'd said he would. Mutt Wilmot, to the eyes of the world, a broken man. Even at a time of national mourning, Mutt was on the spot to provide the memorable moments, the unforgettable images required by death. I almost jumped to my feet and applauded. I knew that the people who witnessed these simple devotions, either in person or on the television screen, would go on talking about them until they sat toothless on a wooden bench in a cottage dooryard waiting for their hearts to stop beating. Mutt Wilmot, the Dimbleby voice went on, producer of Rupert Porson's The Magic Kingdom,
We are told that he was devastated when news came of the puppeteer's death, that he was rushed to hospital for treatment of cardiac palpitations. But in spite of it, and against his doctor's orders, he insisted on being here today to pay tribute to his late colleague. Although we are told on good authority that an ambulance is standing by at the ready, should it be needed. The view from a camera we had not seen before was now cut in. Shooting from a high angle, as if from a rotunda, the view came down and down into the studio as it might be seen through the eyes of a descending angel, getting closer and closer to the coffin until, at its very foot, it came to rest upon a remarkable figure that could have been none other than Snoddy the Squirrel. Mounted on a wooden post, perhaps, the hand puppet, with its little leather ears, protruding teeth, and question mark of a bushy tail, had been carefully arranged to gaze sadly down upon the coffin of its master, its squirrel paws crossed reverently, its squirrel head bent in an attitude of humble prayer. There were often times, and this was one of them, when, as if in the sudden blinding flash of a news photographer's camera, I saw it all. Death was no more than a simple masquerade, and so, moreover, was life. And both of them were artfully arranged by something or other, some backstage celestial Mutt Wilmot. We were puppets, all of us, set in action upon the stage by God, or fate, or chemistry, call it what you will, where we would be pulled on like gloves upon the hands and manipulated by the Rupert Pawsons and Mutt Wilmots of the world, or the Ophelia and Daphne Deluces. I wanted to let out a whoop. How I wished that Nia were here, so that I could share my discovery with her. After all, no one deserved it more. But by now, for all I knew, she was already steering the decrepit Austin van up the slopes of some Welsh mountain to some Welsh village where, with the assistance of some hastily rustled-up real-life Mother Goose, she would unpack her wooden crates and, later tonight, raise the curtain for the gawking villagers in some far-flung St. David's Hall on her own personal vision of Jack and the Beanstalk. With Rupert gone, which of us now is the Galligantus? I wondered. Which of us was now the monster that would come tumbling unexpectedly out of the skies and into the lives of others?
Heartfelt tributes continue to pour in from Land's End to John O'Groats, the announcer was saying, and from abroad.
He paused and gave out a little sigh, as if he had been overwhelmed by the moment.
Here in London, and in spite of the downpour, the queue continues to grow, stretching as far as All Souls Church, and beyond into Langham Place. From above the door of Broadcasting House, the statues of Prospero and Ariel look down upon the hordes of mourners, watching, as if they too share in the common grief. Immediately following today's ceremonies at Broadcasting House, he went on bravely, Rupert Pawson's coffin will be taken to Waterloo Station, and from there to its place of interment at Brookwood Cemetery in Surrey. By now, even Feely could see that we had had enough.
Enough of this maudlin trash, she announced, striding across the room and flipping off the switch.
The picture on the television tube retracted to a tiny point of light and vanished.
Throw open the curtains, Daffy, she ordered, and Daffy sprang to her command. This is so tiresome, all of it. Let's have some light for a change.
What she really wanted, of course, was to have a better squint at Dieter. Too vain to wear her spectacles, Feely had probably seen no more of Rupert's funeral than a dishwater blur. And isn't it pointless being admired at close range by an anxious swain if one is unable to see said swain's rapture? I couldn't help but notice that Father seemed to have overlooked the way in which our first television viewing had been so abruptly terminated, and that he was already slipping away into his own private world. Dogger and Mrs. Mullet went discreetly about their duties, leaving only Aunt Felicity to protest weakly.
"Really, Ophelia," she huffed, "you are most ungrateful. I wanted to have a closer look at the coffin handles. My charlady's son, Arnold, works as a set dresser at the BBC, and his services were especially requested. They gave him a guinea to ferret out some photogenic fittings."
"Sorry, Aunt Felicity," Feely said vaguely, "but funerals give me such awful goose flesh, even on the television. I simply can't bear to watch them."
For a moment, a coolish silence hung in the air, indicating that Aunt Felicity was not so easily mollified.
"I know," Feely added brightly. "Let me offer everyone a chocolate."
And she went for an end-table drawer. Visions of some Victorian hell flapped instantly into my mind. The caves, the flames, the burning pits, the lost souls queued up, much like those mourners outside Broadcasting House, all of them waiting to be flung by an avenging angel into the fire and molten brimstone. Brimstone, after all, was sulfur, chemical symbol S, with whose dioxide I had stuffed the sweets. Bitten into, they would... well, that would hardly bear thinking about. Feely was already walking towards the vicar, ripping the cellophane from the box of ancient chocolates Ned had left on the doorstep, the box with which I had so lovingly tampered.
"Vicar, Aunt Felicity," she said, removing the lid and holding the box out at arm's length. "Have a chocolate. The almond nougats are particularly interesting."
I couldn't let this happen. But what was I to do? It was obvious that Feely had taken my earlier blurted warning as no more than a stupid bluff. Now the vicar was reaching for a sweet, his fingers, like the planchette on a Ouija board, hovering above the chocolates as if some unseen spirit might direct him to the tastiest confection.
"I have dibs on the almond nougats," I shouted. "You promised, Feely."
I lunged forward and snatched the chocolate from the vicar's fingers and at the same instant contrived to stumble on the edge of the carpet, my flailing hands dashing the box from Feely's hands.
"You beast!" Feely shouted. "You filthy little beast!"
It was just like old times. Before she could recover her wits, I had trodden on the box and in a clumsy, windmilling but beautifully choreographed attempt to regain my balance, had managed to grind the whole sticky mess into the Axminster carpet. Dieter, I noticed, had a broad grin on his face, as if it were all jolly good fun. Feely saw it too, and I could tell that she was torn between her Duchess act and swatting my face. Meanwhile, the hydrogen sulfide fumes, which my trampling of the chocolates had released, had begun their deadly work. The room was suddenly filled with the smell of rotten eggs, and what a stench! It smelled as if a sick brontosaurus had broken wind, and I remember wondering for an instant if the drawing room would ever be the same. All of this happened in less time than it takes to tell, and my rapid-fire reflections were broken into by the sound of Father's voice.
"Flavia," he said, in that low, flat tone he uses to express fury. "Go to your room. At once."
His finger trembled as he pointed. There was no point in arguing. With shoulders hunched, as if walking in deep snow, I trudged towards the door. Other than Father, everyone in the room was pretending that nothing had happened. Dieter was fiddling with his collar. Feely was rearranging her skirt as she perched beside him on the sofa, and Daffy was already reaching for a dog-eared copy of King Solomon's Mines. Even Aunt Felicity was glaring fiercely at a loose thread on the sleeve of her tweed jacket, and the vicar, who had drifted across to the French doors, stood gazing out with pretended interest in the ornamental lake and the folly beyond. Halfway across the room, I stopped and retraced my steps. I had almost forgotten something. Digging into my pocket, I pulled out the envelope of extra perforated stamps Miss Cool had given me and handed it to Father.
"These are for you. I hope you like them," I said.
Without looking at it, Father took the envelope from my hand, his quivering finger still pointing. I slunk across the room. I paused at the door and turned.
"If anyone wants me," I said, "I shall be upstairs, weeping at the bottom of my closet."
This is Jane Entwistle. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Weed That Strings the Hangman's Bag by Alan Bradley. This program was directed by Janet Stark. Executive producers Orly Moskowitz and Janet Stark. Text copyright 2010 by Alan Bradley. Production copyright 2010, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.